Hi, listeners. Just a brief message from me, Reva, before this episode begins. As you know, if you have been listening this season, my co-conspirator and friend of the podcast, Dr. Kay Hickson, and I recently founded our school for therapists, The Kiln. And we wanted to let you know that applications for our first cohort for our one-of-a-kind comprehensive supervision and training program are now open. If you have recently graduated your master's program or are about to graduate and you are or will be soon an LPC or LMFT associate in the state of Oregon, you are welcome to apply. The program includes all of your clinical supervision as well as extensive postgraduate training in self of the therapist work, relational psychotherapy, and trauma processing. And you get to hang out with me and Dr. Hickson for 2 years, and we are a good time. To learn more about the program and to apply, you can go to our website, thekilnschool.com, and the application page will also be linked in the show notes of this episode. Applications are due July 31st. And now, please enjoy this episode.
What feels Jewish about therapy to you? Like, what are the things about it that strike you as Jewish? I'm curious.
So much talking. It's the talking.
The talking.
Endless talking.
The talking.
If you are a lefty therapist like me and at all connected to therapist circles that tend to brand themselves with the label social justice, you might have had similar experiences to the one that I am about to describe, where you are sitting in a room of other lefty social justice therapists. Someone refers to therapy as a profession that was founded by white men. And everyone else nods along, having dutifully acknowledged the problematically hegemonic roots of their chosen profession, and can now go on with whatever conversation is about to happen, feeling appropriately chastened. Or perhaps even more likely, you've seen a flashy Instagram square or snappy TikTok proclaiming the problematic white male roots of the profession of therapy, and maybe you even rolled into the comments section, where the discourse unfolds with the requisite lack of nuance that social media requires, and everyone gets to feel good about themselves for being woke. I'm just going to reiterate here that I am a leftist, and thus, this is my subculture to critique and be irritated by. So critique it, I will. There is just one problem with this idea that the profession of therapy is a white male hegemonic construct. And the problem is that it's not true. Sigmund Freud, Anna Freud, Abraham Maslow, Wilhelm Reich, Eric Fromm, Lev Vygotsky, Erik Erikson, Otto Kernberg, Melanie Klein, Alfred Adler, Alice Miller, Viktor Frankl, Fritz Perls, Aaron Beck, Albert Ellis, Salvador Mnuchin, even many of our contemporary theory heroes and celebrity therapists, Judith Herman, Martin Seligman, Francine Shapiro, Richard Schwartz, John Gottman, Peter Levine, Esther Perel, and that's a very partial list. This field was created and constructed and is largely still being created and constructed not simply by white men, but by Jews. And this is not merely incidental or coincidental. It is consequential. Therapy is foundationally and elementally Jewish. I'm Reva Stout, and you're listening to A Therapist Can't Say That, the show where we talk about the things that it feels like a therapist can't say. And before I go on, I know some of you are already getting confused about Jewishness and whiteness and what's what and who's who. So in a moment, I will move us along in the discussion we are going to have about the Jewishness of therapy today. But first, I am going to give a little quick and dirty lesson in terms about what we're talking about when we talk about Jewishness. Jews are an ethno-religious group, which is a concept that tends to be difficult for Americans in particular to grasp. An ethno-religion is a group of people who share a common ethnic and religious background. In this case, Judaism is the religion, Jews are the people, and Jewish is the adjective that refers to either or both the ethnicity and the religion. This is true today, and it has been true. So if you are referring to Jewishness as either only a religion, which is the most common mistake I see people making in 21st century America, or as only an ethnicity, you're already wrong. And if you need more of a primer on this topic than I have time to give you here today, I strongly recommend the Wikipedia article entitled, Who is a Jew?, which we will link to in the show notes.
Now, what relationship does this all have to whiteness? Well, as I hope we all know by now, whiteness is not a biological reality, but a socially constructed category that confers societal advantages using both phenotypical markers and communal knowledge of a person's ancestral background. And while it is true now in 2024 that many ethnic Jews, such as myself, are generally classified in most places as white and receive the societal privileges associated with such, that was certainly not the case in 1856 when Sigmund Freud was born, nor in 1939 when he died. Jews that would now be generally regarded as white, such as Sigmund Freud and myself, were not really beginning to be inducted into whiteness en masse until solidly into the mid-20th century. For context, many prominent American universities didn't remove their quotas limiting the number of Jewish students they would admit until the early 1960s. So when we are talking about the underpinnings of therapy, the history of our field, to describe therapy as a white hegemonic construct is simply wrong. While therapy has, of course, become mainstream over the past 150 years and no doubt has accumulated the baggage of whiteness and other forms of hegemony as it has done so, therapy emerged from a marginalized culture, a liminal socio-cultural space existing in diaspora around the edges and amidst the seams of the mainstream white world. And that actually makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? That a mode of human relating that, like therapy, is so much about getting under the surface of things would come from the margins of a culture and not from its center? I have been wanting to do an episode about the Jewishness of therapy for a long time, and then this past fall was fortunate enough to stumble upon Hannah Baer's beautiful article, Therapy Was Never Secular, in the summer 2022 edition of Jewish Currents magazine, which of course we will also be linking in the show notes, and I highly recommend that you read. The conversation that Hannah and I went on to have, and that I'm about to share with you now, is the one that I didn't know I needed to have about Jewishness and therapy. It felt, as you'll hear Hannah say, shtetly. Something that, as someone living in the culturally rather pallid region of the Pacific Northwest, I get to experience all too rarely. You'll hear us talking about the hidden or erased Jewish roots of therapy, its mysticism, magic, and esotericism, the way both Jewishness and therapy orient us to marking and understanding the past, how therapy is both so much about words and about what it is beyond our ability to speak, and so many more unexpected gems along the way. I think you'll really enjoy it and come away with a richer appreciation for our field's roots. I was super excited when I found your article. I've been really wanting to do an episode for a while on like the Jewishness of therapy. And then I just happened to, I don't even remember how, but I stumbled upon your article just recently and was like thrilled because it's much, I think it's like a really fascinating exploration of this stuff and is much more interesting than what I would have come up with. So I'm very like embedded in like West Coast lefty social justice therapist circles. And one of the sort of common tropes that's often repeated in those circles is like this idea that like therapy is like a Western white man construct. And I always bristle so much at that because to me, I'm like, that's not right. Like this therapy is Jewish. Like therapy is like deeply Jewish. I was just really excited by your piece, and I'd love for you to just talk about like what led you to want to explore it and write that article in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, I'm curious because you said it, what I came up with was different than what you would have come up with, and so I'm curious about your own story about this question as well, because it sounds like you've done some thinking about it. My experience, and I'll try to tell a version of this that's not just kind of recapitulating what was in the article. When I was thinking about going to therapy graduate school, and which is what I say, I guess in this context, I can say what going to a doctoral program in clinical psych. I was introduced to a friend who is a therapist, and she was also a descendant of Holocaust survivors like me. And she had gone to this therapy program. And there was something about meeting her and like what she was like. And our, you know, we've been friends now for like 6 or 7 years. On and off, maybe longer, 7 or 8 years. And, you know, she's now a colleague. But there was something about our connection around this Jewish trauma experience that I kind of was like, oh, I'm going to go to this Jewish grad program where she went and I'll find some piece of that there. She actually was like, you probably shouldn't go to that program. It's kind of like normie. Like you would be a better fit with these other psych programs in the NYC area. But I had this kind of feeling about it where I was like, no, I'm going to do my instinct, which is just to follow this person who I like hanging out with and with whom I share a kind of particular family story. And so then when I got to the program, I was like, wait, this, like, we're all kind of pretending we're not Jewish, or we're pretending that Jewishness isn't a specific subject position. We're kind of collapsing it into whiteness. I think in a way that probably happened for a lot of people's families in the United States in the last 100 years, for reasons related to like survival on the one hand and trying to like accumulate or consolidate privilege on the other hand, which those two things get confused for Jewish people in particular a lot. Also, like what you're saying about like radical lefty West Coast Jews, like that was not the people I went to grad school with. It was like people from New Jersey who had like really expensive bat mitzvahs and were like really excited to be like an uptown therapist or like maybe a downtown therapist. And a lot of them were like really, I came to really love them, but they weren't like freaky at all. Like they had never done any recreational drugs. They didn't have any tattoos. I was so nervous to tell them that I was in an open relationship because I thought that would be too intense for people. You know, like these kinds of things that are sort of like in queer world, you're like, oh yeah, like everyone's like up to some shit. The Jews I went to grad school with were not up to some shit. And so I was like, everyone here is kind of weird. Like everyone here is like traumatized enough in a way that I actually heard you speak about on a different podcast, but about the kind of whatever the things that come up for people in their early development that might contribute to them wanting to be therapists, which can include like being parentified. But, you know, most of the people I was in school with had some kind of funky trauma, and a lot of them had some Holocaust trauma a generation or two back. But they really didn't identify with that. They identified with being like nice girls from Westchester in New Jersey. And so it was like strange.
Oh, that's interesting. I think
that's kind of like what got me on the trail of being like, what's up with this? And then the thing about the program, which was that the program had been a psychodynamic program 30, 20 years prior. And I sort of got the memo coming in, trying to reach out to alums of the program who are older, being like, can you tell me some about this? That they were like, oh yeah, it's just not really psychodynamic anymore. So like who, it's like lost its credibility. It's lost its legitimacy, and traded that in for a different kind of legitimacy, which is that like you can go there and study CBT.
That's such an interesting mirror of, I think, what you just described. I mean, and you refer to this in the article a bit, but like the absorption into whiteness of American Jews and like the trading one kind of cultural embeddedness to gain legitimacy in a different, whiter, you know, more sort of culturally sterile, dominant culture.
Completely, yes. And it was, you know, many of the kind of like, for lack of a more politically correct term, jappy girls that I went to grad school with, many of them became CBT therapists, you know, mm-hmm. with no sense of this kind of like theory that I was starting to formulate, no sense that there was like something particularly Jewish about therapy, not something particularly Jewish about talk therapy or process-oriented therapy or insight-oriented therapy, these kind of different ways people have of hedging to not say what I now feel like I can just call it psychoanalytic therapy,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
exactly. And the way that psychoanalytic is kind of a dirty word, being kind of like, oh yeah, it's kind of like being orthodox. It's like too, it's a little too much, you know, like
right.
you can get into that one, but like it's going to be pretty isolating and people are going to like give you a hard time.
Mm-hmm. Right. I loved that connection you made, the connection between the association with orthodoxy and the distancing that people do with that association. I've really, this past year, I have really gotten into contemporary psychoanalytic theory, spurred on by a couple of like thorny client situations. And then I interviewed Andrea Salenza earlier this year, got into her work. And then that's been like this, to me, amazing gateway drug into a ton of fascinating psychoanalytic stuff. And it's true that I feel like when I'm describing that to people or describing it to clients, I do feel like I have to hedge about it because it seems so weird and old and antiquated. And there is like almost like a, like it's too ethnic or something, like whatever passes for that in our field. I was the only Jew in my cohort because the Pacific Northwest is very, you know, I mean, it's just a culturally homogenous, you know, very white region. And it's very interesting to me because I, third generation therapist, and that's the Jewish side of my family. My grandfather, Jewish grandfather, is the first therapist in our family that I know of. So I've always had like a felt sense of it as very Jewish. And there was, especially being here, there's no, I mean, it's like even the experience that you're describing having where it's like, okay, there's like a lot of Jews here and we're not talking about this. There was none of that for me. And so at some point, just to kind of answer your question about like where I was coming into this, at some point I was just like, am I crazy? Like thinking that this is like a very, very, very Jewish profession. And so at some point I made a list of a bunch of like the big name people throughout the ages, like the big theory people. And at some point, you know, like the Wikipedia early life section where you're like, go to find out if people are Jewish. I did that with like all these people. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, nobody's talking about this. Why are we not talking about this as like a Jewish thing? So that was kind of my way in to this topic. Yeah.
So I had that a similar, it was actually a moment with a friend who I talked about earlier, who cued me about which grad school to go to, even if it was like reverse psychology, and who also was had Holocaust ancestry. And there was a moment I was at their house with them, and there was a copy of Psychoanalytic Dialogues, this academic journal, sitting on their kitchen table. And we weren't even looking at it. Like, we were just like having a seltzer, or a glass of wine or something, and like chatting. And every single name on the back of this book is like so Jewish, like everyone. Uh-huh. And I was like, and they're like Israeli names, and there's like Ashkenazi names, and there's like mm-hmm. Mizrahi. So I was like, what the, this is like so. And my friend was kind of like just like laughing, being like, yeah, it's a funny thing. But it was kind of like there wasn't an immediate point of reference for it, I think, in spite of being surrounded by Jews studying therapy. Mm-hmm. To be like, okay, how do you like get into this one? And when I started doing research about it, I also was like, oh, it's kind of fringy to talk about, I think, in some way. Like,
totally. Yes. No, I agree. It does seem fringy. What are your thoughts about like why that is? Or like the inputs of that?
I mean, we are in a complicated political time to talk about anti-Semitism, but I think like insofar as the way in which I think therapy is Jewish is partly because of mysticism. I think that part of Judaism is still like experiences like a different kind of anti-Semitism than like more assimilated white Jewishness. Like in New York City, there's like anti-Semitic hate crimes throughout the year, most years, and most of them are perpetuated against Orthodox Jewish people, right, who are like the most visibly religious people. And there's something about the mysticism, right? There's also the Orthodox Jewish community can be racist in New York, and there's tensions in neighborhoods. There's other reasons that this stuff comes up. It's not just sort of Jewish victimization alone, but I think there is something about the kind of like what the kind of permissible Jewishness in our time is, like white, affluent, like professional, Ivy League, some ties to Israel, like Zionism is a big part of it. And so other kinds of Jewishness, I think, are differently subject to or vulnerable to anti-Semitism. And I think there's something about the mysticism and saying that therapy is mystical, which is both like also no therapists want to claim, you know, because it's hippie and it's the whole, you know, the reason psychoanalysis itself became discredited was because people who wanted to sell their own special theory of shorter term, more efficient, cheaper therapy were like, it's too mystical, it's not scientific enough, you know? So
that's too many intangibles. Yeah.
Right. Does that like land with you, or what do you think?
No, it does. I think, yes, I like that. I guess what I'm thinking about the past, you know, kind of latter half of the 20th century, the move towards what I would call like scientism and the need to have a scientific explanation for, you know, a reductive scientific explanation for essentially anything. And in the moment that we're in culturally with regards to therapy, I just interviewed a couple weeks ago Kristen Martin, who wrote an article for the Washington Post about the shoddy kind of neuroscience that's underpinning a lot of the, you know, popular Vanderkolk and his kind of crew, and how poorly substantiated that science is right now. And yet that science is the absolute core of everything mental health related. I mean, even the term mental health, right? Like, it's like there's something about right now, the explanation for everything that feels potent for people is like a neuroscience explanation. And so, like, mysticism feels like, even though I don't see them at all as mutually exclusive, I think it's that would be the common way of seeing it, is that those are mutually exclusive. And so I think right now we're just very, you know, in terms of the dominant American culture, we're really in a place that doesn't accept mysticism as like a valid way of engaging with truth and reality. I think some of the shock and collective trauma of losing in the Holocaust the vast majority of Jewish spiritual leadership, a huge body of Jewish spiritual writing that was destroyed, the disconnection that that creates, I feel like that has to be in there somewhere, you know. And thinking about, like, my grandfather, I mean, that, you know, he fought in World War II. My people came here pre-World War II, and all of that weren't present for the Holocaust in Europe, but he fought in World War II, was very driven to, you know, achieve whiteness and assimilate into American culture. And he was drawn to this profession, you know. So there's a lot of, like, I see, like, a lot of what we're talking about just in him.
Yeah, I'm associating from what you're saying to this moment I had a couple years ago. I think I was in Vienna, and I got to go to the Freud Museum, where, you know, the house where he lived. And you go through this whole house, and it's like, I can't totally imagine what it would be like if you didn't care much about him. But I was sort of, like, stunned by being in the actual room where he worked, you know, even though there was no stuff in it, because most of the stuff got moved to London. The museum is set up, you walk through the house and you go up these stairs and down these other stairs, and you go through, like, where Anna Freud worked and all these different rooms and places, and there's all this history. You go to the gift shop cafe area, and there's, like, one final plaque on the wall in a balcony above the gift shop that's like, all of Freud's siblings were killed in the Holocaust, and he was, like, taken out by, ostensibly actually, by a collaboration between, like, multiple Western powers, like, including the US government and other, like, now what we now call, like, EU countries, were like, we're gonna get him out because he was a celebrity, you know.
I had no idea. That's wild. It's very strange to me now that you're talking about that I've never heard that before or thought, because of course that makes sense that would have happened. That is wild. Yeah, that's not, that those two histories are not, like, the history of Freud and all of that and of this field, and then the Holocaust are, like, seen as separate histories. Like, that's,
I mean, it's connected to this thing about assimilation, because I think even my dad was born in 1927 and in Germany, and something he said to me not that long ago was, he was like, you know, the German Jews didn't really want to be Jewish, they wanted to be Germans. And so there was, I think, talking about that time, the way he experienced his own family interfacing with anti-Semitism as it was really sort of rising up, was this wish to assimilate, this wish to be middle class or upper middle class, this wish to, like, just be German, which in the US is to just be white, you know?
Right.
And that was true for Freud too, you know. Freud's parents and grandparents were much more religious, and he was much more assimilated, and scholars debate how mystical he really was. But at this point, there's sort of no contest in this record that he thought about Judaism a lot, and he was sort of engaged with Jewish stories and Jewish ideas, and he was sort of ambivalent about his own identity with it, but maybe also was sort of more mystical than was safe to be in public. Which I wonder, you know, for you as someone who talks to a lot of therapists and talks to therapists about things they're not allowed to talk about, it makes me wonder about what you know about therapists hiding or disavowing their mysticism in the present day.
Oh, I love that. That's such a great question. It's so rich to me. I think I remember talking to my when I was pre-licensed and I was getting supervision, and my supervisor was a therapist in her 60s at that time. And I remember her talking to me and saying that at some point, everybody that she supervises comes to her and says they think that they're psychic, and like that that's part of their like their the way that they, you know, it's in there or something that they work like how they work with their clients and whatever. And I thought that was so fascinating because, like, you know, I remember reading another, you know, good Jewish therapist, like in Irvin Yalom's book, The Gift of Therapy. He talks about having the same dreams as clients sometimes, like, you know, like the level of attunement produces something that feels that does feel like mystical. And you can characterize it from whatever angle you want. But I do think that that, you know, I often use the word magic and like to describe what happens right in the room with my clients, and people. Therapists to me pretty consistently resonate with that and resonate with the experience. I think of, you know, to me, mysticism is so much about the experience of transcendence and, you know, immanence, and how often therapists talk about like, I can't describe, like I can't articulate, like there's something that happens that is beyond what's articulable. And I'm sure that's not a universal experience, but I do think it's more the norm than not for people who are deeply immersed in this work.
Right.
I mean, how do you put that in a fucking insurance note or like describe that as an intervention? You know, it's like I've come to be able to translate that, but there's something that's so much bigger and to me is like holy, actually, about some of the stuff that happens in these relationships and in this context. It's much more interesting to me than what you can describe in terms of mirror neurons, you know?
Yeah, I think it's evocative to hear you say it like that. And for myself as well, it feels like a kind of uncomplicatedly sacred thing. In Buddhist tradition as well as Jewish tradition, you know, like the this kind of Buddhist deity that whose great power is listening, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, the figure of the rabbi who somehow heals people by just sitting with them and listening to them. Mm-hmm. And even keeps communities together. Like there's something that's so sort of it's such an obviously mystical thing in some way. And it's something that also like has a lot of science behind it at this point that like.
Totally. Yeah.
Even like an untrained empathetic listener can help people's like medical prognoses and help people's emotional distress quantifiably. Right. So we know that. And there's something sort of, even if you're like very kind of secular, I think a lot of, I work right now at a very psychoanalytic hospital. And so a lot of the people I work with are very like, kind of sciencey and wanting to reclaim psychoanalysis as a sort of like rigorous practice, but they are all woo-woo around the edges, even though they would kind of deny it if you press them. They're all kind of like, yeah, the thing like the echoes in the dreams and the associating to the same thing at the same time and the having like these funny fantasies about each other. And I think what most of them would say is just being like, yeah, well, those, that's my feeling about that. That's my affect around it. Like the idea of mysticism is a kind of like affective experience that you can decode or is like fodder for the analysis, which I kind of love. It's kind of relaxing for me because then I can just, I've been able to appreciate that working with people who are basically working with super majority psychoanalysts right now, I've been relieved at how woo they are without having any, most of them probably wouldn't even know what that term, like I'm talking about like people in their 70s who like wear a bow tie every day, you know, like it's like really kind of like old worldly people, but it's still like they will be like, oh yeah, like you, they want to talk about what your dream means about like their childhood and you're like, okay, let's fucking go.
Yes. Oh, that's, I love that. Yeah. That made me think of my teacher in the trauma work that I do, David Schnarch, who is also Jewish. At our trainings, we would use, as you know, one often does in trainings in our field, we'd use our own material, you know, and it was a lot of narrative and dialogue based work. And he'd anonymize our stuff and like put it up on a screen, you know, in front of 50 of our colleagues and analyze it. He was so good. It was like getting a psychic reading. Like it felt like he could take your dialogue or your, you know, whatever you wrote about your fantasy and just like bang, 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 be like, this person's, you know, familial dynamics were this. And here's the, and it would just be like wildly accurate. And that felt incredibly, I mean, it felt incredibly mystical. It felt incredibly spiritual to be like read like that. And he was a total, I think he was like sort of, you know, like in the Jewish tradition of like Buddhist adjacent atheist Jews. He was like that kind of guy. But it did feel mystical, and it didn't need to have the label on it, you know, or like a sort of the trappings of woo as we probably in our generation think of them now. It didn't have to have that on it to be that.
Right. Well, and I think there's something that's so like, not to be sound like an old person, which increasingly I realize I am, but I think there's something about, I think probably since I was in my early 20s and sort of getting politicized, I was trying to ask these questions about like what's weird or off about identity politics. And I think one of the things that I've struggled with is the way that it kind of neatly dovetails with like consumer identity, like being like, well, I'm like a this person, structural identities is kind of like being like, well, I wear Adidas and I shop at Whole Foods. And so like, you can tell these things about me when in fact, like, I'm like a white Jewish trans woman who lives in the Northeastern United States. And that might mean certain things about me. And it also might not. And you actually, because of living in consumerism, I think we get confused about what the labels mean. And there is something about the way that the woo of therapy is sort of like unspeakable that also makes it like you don't have to then be like, well, I'm actually in this lineage of Buddhism and was raised in this kind of Jewish tradition to be like a Jew-boo, this kind of clinical practitioner, like, because no one wants to talk about it and no one cares. And if people have thought about it a lot, it's kind of because they talk about it with their friends and haven't like, it hasn't kind of been mapped by, even within the subculture of therapy and therapists hasn't really been like mapped and described exactly. And there's a part of that that I kind of, as someone who also grew up in subculture and like appreciates things that are kind of clandestine or that not everyone knows about, or that like, if you know, kind of things can feel like to me, like the most special, which is also very Jewish, I think.
Yes. I love that. Yeah. It's like there's some place that the real stuff is happening and it doesn't have like a name on the door, and you just find it on Google Maps, so to speak. Like, it's like you have to kind of find it. You come in the side door and it's something that is beyond what can be contained in those labels or commodified. Yeah. This is maybe like a broad question, but what feels Jewish about therapy to you? Like, what are the things about it that like that strike you as Jewish? I'm curious.
So much talking. It's the talking.
The talking.
Endless talking.
Talking.
Which is why it's funny when, like, part of my dissertation research, I had to watch hours and hours of DBT videos. Uh-huh. And I was like, there's just is a different thing going on when the therapist gets up and draws on a whiteboard, when they have a patient fill out stuff on a clipboard. And I actually, like, as someone in analytic training, I'm, like, pretty integrative. Like, I actually think DBT is great. And I also, because it's Buddhist, sort of transparently,
right?
It's,
yeah,
it's copyrighted white Buddhism.
It totally is, yes.
Because that is what it is. I also like have a kind of reverence for it, and I think it really helps people. But it feels less Jewy because it's not just people like sitting in comfy chairs, like talking. Like there's this kind of the structure and the way in which it's a bit more task oriented rather than process and relationship and like association, like mental, like free association oriented, make it feel a little bit more like HR and a little bit less like hanging out with like your Jewish friend or something.
Uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
A little less shtetly.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's interesting because here, like the what's considered like cutting edge and what like the sort of like cool young therapists, I think I've aged out of that. I'm 41, so I'm not a cool young therapist anymore. But so the cool young therapists are all doing somatic stuff now. I don't have a problem with that, but it's interesting because a lot of the ways that that's manifesting from what I'm hearing from people who have gotten that kind of therapy, including some of the therapists who do that kind of therapy, is how it's not talky and it's not relational. And there's something there's a lot about like various somatic therapies that I find really interesting and sort of tried to get into, but I cannot get away from the talking. Like the talking is like, that's it for me. I love it. And it's interesting to have people come in who've had the other kind and they're having a completely different experience with the talking and the relational and the analyzing. For me, I use a lot of written material. Right now I'm doing So I do a lot of, and I have for a while, a lot of recording of clients telling their trauma stories and do a lot of like close reading of that kind of stuff, which close reading feels very incredibly Jewish to me. And now, right now, I'm getting into doing recording sessions and having transcripts of sessions that clients and I look at and like talk about what, like, getting the picture of the session and then looking at what's happening, getting under to the next layer outside of session by looking at what's happening between us, which feels like Talmudic. And like, you know, it's just like, it really feels Jewish in a way that I find fascinating. And even the stuff with Freud, as I've been getting into contemporary psychoanalytic literature, the way people go back to Freud and reinterpret him, I'm like, this is very much like Torah study, you know, and the
100%.
like pretty much the same thing, except it's Freud and not the Torah, you know, which I find so fascinating.
I love what you're saying about the having the text in front of you to refer back to, and you know, like working in a psychoanalytic setting, there's a, and this is part of the woo of the setting, I am in a group that meets every week where we do, one person presents their process notes from the session, and then everyone else talks about it with them. It's from memory. And part of the thing is that I've been told multiple times when, you know, as a relatively new person in analytic training, I'm like, well, what if you get something wrong? What if you don't remember it right? And my supervisor's been like, well, it's how you're holding it in your mind. Like what you remember is actually more important than what is literally happened, because it's all in the mind. And that to me is so woo, you know?
Yeah. It's also very like, do you know that it is not in the heavens, that story? It's a little Talmudic story.
No, will you tell?
Yes, I'll tell you. It's one of my favorites. The reason I know about it, I'm very far from a, you know, I don't know a lot of Jewish deep cuts. The reason I know it is because Karen Armstrong's book, The Case for God, she features it, which is, if you haven't read that, it's fantastic and talks a lot about the stuff about mysticism that we've been getting at. But so it's this story in the Talmud where it's two rabbis are, you know, as they do, disagreeing about some interpretation of Torah. And so one of the rabbis he asks the angels to do a miracle if he's right, like to prove that, you know, his interpretation is correct. Do these miracles. And so the angels come down, they do the miracles, they make water in the rivers flow upstreams, all of this stuff. And the rabbi who has the other interpretation is completely unimpressed. And he just says, it is not in the heavens, meaning the Torah is not in the heavens. It's here for us to interpret and make meaning of. So it doesn't matter what God thinks, and it doesn't matter that the angels are telling me you're right. So it just came to mind. Yeah, when
absolutely.
You said that.
Absolutely. No, 100%. It's very that. It's very like that. I'm so struck by you doing that practice in that way, especially thinking about trauma work and the way that more kind of like task-oriented therapists talk about exposure. Mm-hmm. And where the sort of CBT therapists who I trained with in grad school were like, I think at some point someone was like, does EMDR really work? And they were like, well, there's evidence that it works, but the evidence suggests that it's not the eye movement or the tapping, it's the exposure, component.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then being able to be like, well, you can do anything you want to get to the exposure, you know, but exactly. One way what you're describing is being like, oh, can you take something that was so hard to talk about? It actually might be kind of unthinkable later on, or it might be hard to remember. And can you revisit it not as like your internal experience of being in therapy last week, but actually as like an object
a
outside
text,
of
right.
you?
Yeah.
Which is such a beautiful thing about, I think, like a lot of friends who are in creative writing professionally and who are run writing groups or teach writing classes, it's like a powerful gift to give people to be like, look at this thing from inside of you, outside, like past part of your interiority around the classroom, you know?
Right. Yes. And something that I haven't expected that has happened that I rarely talk about. So I have all these texts now. And I get like I give these the ones that I sometimes we kind of compress them into like a take the dialogue and then turn it into cohesive narrative. And then clients will take those and kind of have them, and they'll have their little book of like their stories, which is so cool. And I now have hundreds of narratives of people's trauma stories that I just have, which obviously can't share with anyone, but I have them all and read them sometimes because, you know, ostensibly because it improves my clinical skills, which it does. But they do feel to me like holy texts now. It's like these are people's stories of like some of the most intimate, difficult things that have ever happened to them that I now have this library of that is secret and private. That's fucking mystical, you know, and
absolutely.
Like it's trippy to think about that way. And I don't have that much time to think about it that way. But now that we're sitting and talking, I'm like, God, it's really like it's wild, you know, and it feels very akin to everything that we're talking about here.
Yeah, the listeners can't see, but I'm like shaking my head and nodding back and forth, thinking about just even wondering like that, what a potent set of objects, like where in your space do you keep it? Like, how do you, what, like, do you keep like stuff around it to sort of protect it or to, I don't know, it's a very profound illustration of some of, I think, what we're talking about just how it is so quickly this work starts to verge into something that feels less like science, how we think of science culturally, and more like what we think of as some kind of like spiritual or sacred stewardship of people's experiences.
I really loved what you said about the connection between some of the like psychoanalytic principles and Jewishness, one of them being the textuality and interpretability of all reality. I love that. You know, I'm thinking about the way, you know, the guidelines for Torah study, right, being that you are guided to look at it on multiple layers, that you're supposed to look at it on the literal, the symbolic, like all the different possible layers of meaning. And that, you know, from a psychoanalytic lens, especially like, you know, the kind of way that I'm applying the psychoanalytic lens right now is in the, you know, therapist-client relationship, looking at the layers of like what's happening literally, what's happening symbolically, and all of those things being true at the same time, and yet sometimes in tension and conflict with each other. That feels like another just like very Jewish way to hold something, you know?
Completely. As you were talking, I was starting to think about, my mind went somewhere else, which is interesting. But I think it's because right now I've been thinking a lot about Israel-Palestine.
Yeah.
And about this kind of like, I'm still thinking about your box of trauma texts and this idea of therapy as a way to help people not reenact their trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you were abused as a kid to not become an abusive parent, if you were abandoned as a kid to not abandon the people in your life, you know, these kinds of basic things that people without help and without care and kind of spiritual guidance or clinical guidance might tend to repeat. And my understanding of what's happening in Gaza is this kind of like repetition of a trauma, you know, that Zionism, you know, whatever you believe about Zionism as a idea or as a the validity of it or not, or the extent to which Israel can exist.
Right.
In either case, the violence against Palestinians seems so clearly to be this recreation of the violence of the Holocaust and this trauma repetition, and that the promise of the work that we do is the promise of possibly not doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ability to be traumatized and then not go out and do it again to someone else,
mm-hmm.
Which like some number of Jews on the planet are really publicly failing to do right now with sort of catastrophic consequences. But that is another way in which like when we are talking about the Jewishness of therapy, talking about not necessarily something that all Jews do or are doing right now, but something that also like is in the mix of like what Jews could do, or like a potential, like a kind of a hopefulness around Jewishness and Judaism, which I think I've been really struggling with lately because of having a lot of shame and pain about like what's being enacted, quote unquote, in our names, you
uh-huh.
know?
Yeah.
And the way that Zionists have attempted to sort of claim all Jews, and how it's sort of the flickering nature of Jewish whiteness in the moment when suddenly you're like, oh, to be a Jew is to belong to this ethno state that like you're supposed to go to, and like it's not safe to be in your home country anymore. Like that sort of being the existence of Zionism being an insistence on like Jewish ethnicity, which then in a funny way like de-assimilates us from whiteness. Like it's complicated ideas, but just a wish, I think, for Jews to contextualize their trauma more, and that being sort of part of the way in which therapy isn't Jewish the way that Israel is Jewish, but it's sort of more like radically Jewish. And that is like an important distinction to make in this time when I think these categories are being contested really publicly, and also kind of like there's a lot of profound anger and trauma that's happened in real time, people getting really, really killed and maimed and having their entire lives and communities and homes and cities destroyed in the name of sort of protecting Jewishness. So
I think my awareness that, you know, there's a lot of kind of, I think sometimes kind of pat talk about like, but Jews experienced the Holocaust, so how can they do? And I'm like, that is not, repetition of trauma is the norm. Taking trauma, metabolizing it, and being able to shift forward to not repeat those patterns, that is not the norm. That's why, like, as you're saying, like, that's why these like interventions exist. Like, that's why this, it's like to get people to a place where they can divert pattern significantly versus repeating trauma in some iteration or another is very difficult to do. And watching this writ large, you know, on the world stage, all of us watching through social media and the like layers of experience that that creates, it's really something. Like there's something you said, I don't remember exactly how you put it, but about the Jewishness of therapy being different than the Jewishness of something like the Israeli state, right? Of course, as any culture, like what Jewishness is multifaceted and complex. Like the way that concept of Jewishness gets recruited into various agendas, right? The Israeli government having its own, you know, very particular agenda. And then I guess like to me, you know, my kid has a Jewish name. I have a fantasy that someday I'm going to take her to synagogue. I had her during the pandemic. So it's like that whole fantasy was like not, you know, the things I was going to do, I have not caught up with yet. And this work to me is the most Jewish thing that I do, really. It's the most Jewishy way that I engage with life. And it's like, it is, you know, a huge percentage of my life. Like my life is in many ways structured around this work. And so I don't know. There's something about what it means to like carry forward Jewishness in this way and to name it. And I'm having this episode on this podcast because I think it's important to name it and I want to claim it in a different way than how often Jewishness is claimed, you know, and that goes for, you know, from the Zionist ideology also to something that has often very frustrated me in the like leftist, you know, anti-Zionist political culture that I've been more embedded in, which is that Jewishness seems to be defined no matter what by one's relationship to Israel. And I have to contend with Israel. We all have to contend with Israel. That's like part of it in this reality, but I don't want my Jewishness to be centered there. It's centered in something else. So to claim it for me means claiming it differently. And somehow this is part of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's so powerful. And I think it's powerful also because it's so contested, right? Like I was speaking at work about having been met up with a group of Jewish therapists who were very upset about Gaza, you know, like all kind of lefty, activist-y, super majority queer and trans therapists, and talking about how it would be so, basically talking about challenges working with patients who were Zionists right now. That was kind of like one of the things the group came together to talk about. And I mentioned this to one of my colleagues at work, and the colleague was like, well, do you mean how upset they would be to work with a Jewish person right now? And I was like, no, they're like having to like pull that apart for non-Jews and Jews alike, that there is this kind of like, it gets really quite slippery. And I do think being able to define a radical Judaism outside of an ethno-nationalist militarized project is so vital to preserving what's kind of essential to this, my experience of my life and history and culture, this incarnation. You know, it's like, of course I'm Jewish, you know, but there's this thing when Hannah Arendt talks about evil, one of the things she says about it when she was writing about the banality of evil, which incidentally is writing that she got in a lot of trouble with by the ADL in the 1960s because she wasn't being like writing along the Zionist line enough, and they called her a self-hating Jew. But one of the things she says about evil is she's like, evil is not radical. And she's like, what I mean by that is that it's like, it doesn't go to the root, kind of going radix being like root in Latin. And so this idea of being like, well, a radical Judaism would go to the root of what Judaism is rather than like ethno-nationalism, which is sort of, to me, is like not the root of what our tradition is.
Oh, man, it's such a rabbit hole. The like, what is the root? To me, that calls back to that sense of, I guess, the reality of how much is still being rebuilt and, you know, reconstructed or whatever and refound, you know, post-Holocaust. I think in American culture, we're so oriented to the now, and the idea of that, you know, 70 years is a long time ago. And the reality is that's a very short time, certainly not a long enough time to have like metabolized something like that level of collective trauma. There's something about that to me about like finding the root, right? Of like what, like there's something that goes together with that to me.
When I was younger, I studied management consulting for some reason. And one of the things that I got really interested in that field was how when a new CEO comes into a company, they're supposed to like get rid of the old logo and make the new logo. And one of the things I got really interested in companies, and I now sort of have a interest in whenever I join a new organization, which is now as, you know, as a therapist, is understanding the organizational history, like what was going on here 10, 20, 30 years ago, like who's been here the longest? What do they remember? Like what are the myths and kind of cultural pieces within an organization? Some threads in consulting are connected to anthropology and like it's just a different nerdy subdiscipline. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something about that set of questions that struck me, just as you're saying, when I was thinking about that a lot then, as sort of un-American. Like America is very sort of in the now, as you said, and even focused on the future, bringing in the new, again, this kind of consumerist mindset of being like, what product is going to drop next year? You know, like totally. Watching the preview of the Apple products the way that someone in like another time might have watched like an important political or spiritual event, because that's sort of how we make and understand culture, is like, what can our laptops and smartphones do now? And that future orientation having many different funny specific problems with it, but one of them is the erasure of like how things are or were or felt in the past. And I don't know if you found this doing therapy with people, but I'm often surprised at how people haven't thought about or metabolized ways that their parents or grandparents' trauma experiences, migration experiences might be like blueprinted into whatever is going on for them.
Yes.
You know, my dad's a Holocaust survivor. My mom is a family doctor. So she was like talking to me about her parents' medical history when I was a kid, being like, you might struggle with this because your grandmother, da da da. So it's like very sort of instinctive to me, and is a way that I experience my secular Jewish family to be quite Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of like fixation, or at least sort of like preoccupation with the past and the importance of acknowledging and understanding the past and marking it in some way, which isn't what white people and colonizers and people who capitalists necessarily are interested in doing, partly because it's inefficient. The least nefarious reason to ignore it is because it's, you know, it doesn't, mm-hmm. it's not as productive as like focusing on the next new thing, the next product, the next big event.
Totally fascinated by what you're saying. First thing, I on my intake form, I had a section that asks people about their ancestry or their ethnic background. And I had to change it because everybody, all, you know, the majority of my clients are white. All those people just kept writing white. And so I had to change it to please be as specific as possible if you know your ancestry. Because otherwise people are just like, I'm white. And I'm like, I'm not asking because I'm asking because this is relevant to you. You know, like the majority of people, white people in America, don't see it that way. They are conditioned to not see it that way. And then as you were talking, I was thinking about the different branches of my family. The Jewish side kept everything. That piece of furniture that you see behind me was my grandmother's piece of furniture that my mom had. Now I have, you know, I have all these old papers, letters and interesting stuff that my grandparents had when they were like activists and trying to free political prisoners and the Soviet Union and all of this stuff. We have all of this stuff on that side of the family, and cleaning out the house, you know, after their death was a big project and everything. On the other side of my family, the not Jewish side, they're German mostly. And that side of my family, just this long history of like getting rid of family photos, burning things, like getting rid of stuff. There's this intense compulsion to erase and get rid of things. And the contrast of that is so fascinating to me, and have both of those sides of my lineage. In myself, I notice like both impulses, which is an interesting thing to, you know, sort of little polarization to try to navigate. But I've actually become quite adept at telling when people have German ancestry by how they describe their family. And these are people whose families have been here for hundreds of years, but those behaviors and those patterns are still the same. It's really been interesting just to see the impact, and what we're doing, this focus on the past and documenting and dredging through and understanding the impact of the past, really feels like absolutely like a Jewish cultural heritage to me. Whether that's our personal pasts or, you know, familial, intergenerational, compared to what you're talking about, that like future orientation, where we are as a field is so similar to like looking to the next iPhone. What's the next new modality that's going to come out, instead of, you know, often exploring the richness of the stuff that has been established and the wisdom that is there and is available being passed down intergenerationally in the field, but isn't kind of as like sexy and new iPhone-y, you know?
And what I'm about to say is maybe a little abstract, so I'll try to make it clear, but there's something in consumerism about like kind of the authority of the consumer, like the customer is always right, or, you know, like whatever people are willing to buy or whatever they want, that's what they should have. And we know that that's tremendously destructive, right? Like our phone, there's all this research about how our phones are designed to be compulsively used, and they're terrible for our mental health. And, you know, the food that's cheapest and most available and it's always like tastes the best, it's like very bad food,
not nourishing,
know?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Like Doritos are an incredible food, but like you shouldn't eat them very much if you want to be really healthy, you know? So this idea of having a kind of consumerist approach to mental health treatment, where people are sort of shopping for the authority of the consumer, sort of people shopping for a treatment, largely not being educated on what the different therapy modalities are, and that being a sort of huge source of confusion for people about being like, I went to go see a therapist, I had no way of knowing what they were going to be doing with me, and also not knowing kind of what the options are, you know, and it being pretty expensive and time consuming to even feel that out. And then the whole question of personality match also being unresolved. And then on top of that, the question of like managed care and insurance coverage, there's just this like tremendous, the way that in neoliberalism, therapy has become kind of like something you shop for, but you have limited options because of some decision that someone in a corporation made. And then you have to negotiate with like all of these kind of like people running small businesses who are like maybe like a little extractive, or like who like costs a lot of money to go see. There is this way in which it's sort of like the authority of clinicians to be like, no, this works. I believe that it works. And it's, and I can help you get there with me, more the way that it would be like with a rabbi or with like a spiritual teacher, where you're like, well, you would just go to study with the person because you were picking up what they were putting down, or it was part of a tradition or a lineage, or it's what people in your family did. Like these kinds of authority that we erase now in favor of being like, well, did you do like a master's degree? Like what kind of master? Like this kind of, again, the way that graduate school is kind of corporate in its own funny way.
Yeah, there's so many great things you just said. I think the consumer, like the idea of therapy as a consumer product and like consumer authority, that's such a fantastic point. And because I've talked with some other therapist friends about the way it does seem like there's like this customer service mentality that is confused often with being client centered. There's a tension because like there's a tension between, yes, needing to be responsive and respect a client's sense of themselves. And also, just because somebody read a book about a modality that sounded good to them and resonated with them doesn't actually mean that that's going to be the therapy that like does it for them. And I increasingly find that I have to contend with people's ideas that they've gotten off like social media, you know, whatever, about what kinds of therapy are effective. And it's all the newest, you know, it's all the new books, it's all the new stuff. And that's fine. But I'm aware of the marketing aspect of it too, you know, and the way like, now that I do teaching and I do case presentations, I know that what is written in a book is about a case and what worked is incredibly sanitized version. You know, nobody's putting their full messiness of their cases out in a book and being like, do it this way. There's something esoteric, to get back to that mysticism piece, there's something esoteric about what we do that cannot yes. actually be fully communicated to a client before that you take them through the process. It just can't. And that's at odds with that like consumer product mindset that you're talking about.
There's a way in which I think that it's like a disempowering position for a patient, but it's maybe preferable than the disempowerment of sort of believing that something that is trendy is effective, which is sort of kind of a rough place to be in, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. We should probably wrap up in a minute here. First of all, before we do that, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that we didn't get to?
Well, maybe just that I think as a kind of like pluralist leftist Jew, and by talking about how therapy is Jewish, I don't mean to undermine the ability of non-Jewish people to do it and to interpret it and to create it, but that I do think it's so amazing for people who are practicing therapy to study the history of it and to study even the history of the modalities they're interested in. Like reading Marsha Linehan's memoir changed my life. Like understanding, being like, oh, of course you had to be hospitalized and then go to a Zen Buddhist monastery. Like, and then similarly with like Aaron Beck, the person who developed CBT, like, you know, like he was Jewish and he was trained as a psychoanalyst and then eventually butt heads with psychoanalysts. But knowing that history, I think for anyone, whether or not you're Jewish and whether or not you're psychodynamic, I think can really powerfully inform the work that we do. So that's one idea that I think is good to land on.
Right. The history matters. The past matters. The history matters.
Yeah. And helps us.
Yeah, totally. Last thing, so I like to ask people to share if they have one, what I call an "a therapist can't say that" moment. And so that's a moment where you say something, whether that's to, I mean, anybody, colleagues, clients, people in general, and you have that moment of knowing that that's like not a thing therapists are supposed to say. I like to collect those anecdotes. So if you have one, I'd love for you to share it.
That's such a good question. I think I have moments like that all the time because I have parts of my life where I'm not primarily a therapist and I have parts of my life where I primarily am, and that they're very separate. There was a moment in a clinical meeting a year or two ago where someone was talking about ketamine treatment and about how someone else was talking about like, well, you can know some people use it recreationally, and then someone else was like, does it cause, like, is there health effects to that? And I kind of like blurted out that there was like some research about ketamine in the bladder in recreational ketamine use. And everyone kind of turned and looked at me like, why would you know that? And I was like, just like, let's not go, let's stop talking about this. But that was definitely one of my, a therapist can't say that moment.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I love that. That's funny. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. It's been great talking to you. This has been, I feel like this is one of those conversations where I'm like, wow, I didn't know I needed that. But this has just been really, it feels like a really nourishing conversation to have. And I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Same. It's so, so fun to talk about and think about this stuff and to hear some about your work and how deeply you're asking these questions. And in a way, it sounds like trying to politicize and, yeah, like keep the mysticism of this work alive. And that means everything to me. So I'm really honored to have been invited by you and get to know you a little bit and speak with you. So thank you.
Before I wrap up, I want to share a little bit with you about an organization that I support and whose signal I would like to boost a bit. You heard me and Hannah briefly talking a bit about Israel and Gaza. Hannah and I spoke back in November, and it's devastating that I'm recording this in March and the genocide in Gaza is still ongoing. If I had produced this episode a year ago, I probably would not have talked about Israel at all, for exactly the reason you heard me saying to Hannah, that I expressly don't want to center my Jewishness around Israel or Zionism, either pro or anti. And you also heard me say that, as a Jew, I know I have to contend with Israel. And that is true in this political moment more than it has ever been in my adult life. And so part of how I am contending with it is by talking about it in this context where I really wish I didn't have to. All that is to say that one of the very few things giving me a spark of hope in this very ugly political time and context has been the organization Standing Together. Standing Together is a Jewish and Palestinian solidarity organization in Israel whose members have been working very hard for ceasefire and for the long-term goals of an end to the occupation and a future of freedom, equality, and peace for everyone that lives in the land of Israel and Palestine. They are doing very important work under very repressive and acrimonious political conditions and could use your support. I send them a monthly donation, and they could also use amplification of their message on social media, so check them out. We'll link them in the show notes. Thank you for being here with us on the opening episode of the third season of A Therapist Can't Say That. I am so happy to be back, and I am looking forward to all the juicy content we are going to share with you this season. If you're enjoying the show, please rate, review, and follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to share the show with a therapist friend who you know really wants to join us in talking about the things it feels like a therapist can't say. As always, you can find me, Reba Stout, at intothewoodsportland.com and now also at thekilnschool.com. I love hearing your thoughts, feedback, critiques, complaints, compliments, suggestions, and of course your A Therapist Can't Say That moments. Feel free to reach out to me via email or sending me a voice note to Reva@intothewoodsportland.com. Talk to you next time.